This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April the 25th, 2016. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. And this week, we've got a few things to look at. First, we're going to talk about a circuit court opinion where the Seventh Circuit tells us the hobby loss regulations are simply goofy. We're going to take a look at a warning the IRS issued regarding tax professional systems that have been targeted for takeovers by third parties looking to file false returns using the tax preparer's own files and his own clients. We're going to talk about whether tax credit carryovers survived the death of the spouse that generates the credits. We're also going to look at the fact that the IRS denied a request to approve a deduction for a program that was meant to encourage employee contributions to a political action committee. The IRS backtracked on a bad boy provision on non-recourse loans that caused a lot of controversy earlier in the year. Clarifying examples have been added to the program-related investment rules for private foundations, and we discovered that ignorance did not lead to marital bliss, nor getting out of the taxes that were generated by the other spouse's business. As I said, this week, Current Federal Tax Developments brought to you by Nichols Patrick and your state society. Remember that this is the time of the year we have choices to make. Many of you have probably recently received catalogs from your state societies outlining the courses that are coming up that you can be taking here shortly. Remember, of course, that CP season being upon us, this is the time you make decisions about how you get your education. And your choice here with CPE is whether you view it as just filling in 8 hours or filling in 40 hours or however many hours one needs for the time period for your renewal, or whether you view it as an opportunity to learn how to add skills that will actually help you serve your clients. If you're in the latter category, then you might want to specifically consider some of the advantages of the 8-hour full-day sessions on specialized topics that you really can only find via your state societies. So you want to take a look at those catalogs, make some decisions, go forward. We're coming up this month. I've got a few sessions coming up in the coming months. I'm going to be doing a business and industry tax update in Phoenix on May 9th. May 10th and 11th, I'll move up to Bellevue, Washington, just outside of Seattle. Have one course on identity theft, information security on tax practice, and a course on fringe benefits. And then late in the month, I go to Oregon in Beaverton, just outside of Portland. We're going to talk about tax research systems and methods and assisting the survivors of the decedent's estates. But the state societies have a bunch of other programs you want to take a look at and consider signing up for that education as you look to build your skill set. But now let's go ahead and start taking a look at what we actually had happen this week. And we're going to start with a scary story. This is one the IRS issued on the 15th of April. And the issue in this case was in the e-news for tax professional issue 2016-15, the IRS issued a notice telling us that they had become aware of third parties that had taken over tax preparers' computer systems on their networks. And the idea was they would use those systems to file fraudulent returns on behalf of the preparer's clients, generating refunds that would be then siphoned off into third-party bank accounts that obviously weren't the clients. The problem here is obviously that, and it's something that we should be aware of, this one isn't surprising. A few weeks ago, I told you about the fact that the IP PIN program being broken into at the IRS was not surprising and should have been predicted. And I believe, you know, I was critical of the service at that point. Unfortunately, this is the other shoe to drop that I've been worried about coming, and I've suggested it's going to come for a while. As the IRS begins to make it more difficult for people to file fake returns, just by setting up an e-file account and running a fraudulent e-file account on their own, it will now become important to find a way to submit these fraudulent returns in a way that doesn't appear to be coming from a fraudulent source. As the IRS hardens their systems, these guys are going to go after the weakest link. And at this point, that weak link is going to become many preparers who are not adequately set up to handle the idea that their systems may be under attack. CPAs specifically need to understand the nature of the attack and the defenses to the attack. Now, the IRS suggests 4 things in dealing with this, some of which I think are more useful than others. Number one, they suggest you run a deep security scan on your system. Not a bad idea, but honestly, probably not going to catch it. Most of these malware products, actually, you can subscribe to services with Bitcoin that will make sure your malware works around all the major security products. So the odds are if it got on your system, it will have worked around the product. And then the next thing it does is disables the product from discovering it again. So may or may not be useful doing that deep scan. Can't hurt. You should be aware that most security products do a simple scan, but you can send them into a deeper one. It does make sense every so often to go for that. Hey, sometimes they just get lazy and you'll discover this stuff if you go there. Also, they suggest strongly that you strengthen your passwords. I will tell you, huge thing is don't reuse passwords. Consider whether you want to limit passwords. So, for instance, it takes a different password than the one that gets into your system to log on to and use the attack software. Consider whether or not passwords are actually secure for your staff. You know, people using the names of their kids or the word password as a password, not exactly a strong password system. So if somebody gets access to the network, they can quickly get access to the machine. Also, make sure your staff is aware and is alert for phishing scams. Now, the IRS unfortunately says be aware of emails that come from unknown sources. I will tell you, be aware of emails that come from known sources. I have seen, and actually had happen this late fall, an email, and I'm sure you've all seen these come in. Usually in the past, it's been that somebody you know is supposedly stuck in some country overseas and they need money and please wire it right away. Well, those scams can work the same way with your client's data. If your client database, if your client's, let's say, contact list comes into the wild, you may get an email purporting to be from your client that asks you to open something or link something that would be used to take over the system. Be very wary of any attachments or links in emails from any source unless you're very, very, very sure that it's a legitimate source of the email and legitimate source of the link. And finally, make sure that all staff members have been educated about the problems that we have and how to handle them. Next up, we're going to talk about the case of Vichich versus Commissioner, 146 TC number 12, issued on April the 21st. This was the first time the tax court had to deal with this particular situation. In this case, the taxpayer's spouse died with unused minimum tax credit carryover. Now, interestingly enough, in this case, the credit carryover came when this person had been married to a different spouse. So this person divorces one spouse, marries another, continues to have this credit carryover and carries it forward. Then this person dies. Now, a number of years later, Congress made the minimum tax credit refundable. So the surviving spouse attempted to claim that refundable credit, which was in the six-figure range. When she first submitted the claim, she submitted an amended return, asked for money back, and she did attach an 8275 disclosing her position. The IRS refunded that money. Now, she would also then come back and apply for it, put it on, do another amended return where she asked for larger money. This is when we went to the two-year refundable period when she was able to get half of it in each year. They disallowed that claim, but they initially allowed a claim for the following year when she filed it on the return. Because effectively, you know, it went through processing, they paid it, then it came back, assessed the tax. Now, the IRS said, wait. When your husband died, the minimum tax credit, which was all related to his income, this was not a community property state. This is in Ohio. So we're not going to deal with the question. Those of you in California, Arizona may start thinking, or Idaho may start thinking about, wait, community property. No. This was not a community property state. It was Ohio. There is no question it was the spouse that died that generated the credit. It came, in fact, from his return that he'd filed with another spouse. So there's no question this person, it was not her credit. But she claimed it should survive his death because they'd filed joint returns. The tax court said no. In this case, the same rule should apply here that applies to deductions, which generally we talked about net operating losses, capital loss carryovers, and the like in deductions. Those do die with the spouse that dies. You have to determine how much of the loss when you were in filing joint returns and you have these carryovers, how much of it relates to the surviving spouse. Any of it that relates to the deceased spouse disappears if not used on that final return. This reminds us of an important planning concept. When you have a passing of a spouse, if there are any carryovers, it may be very important to try to arrange to use them up, even if you have to accelerate income into that final return year in order to be able to use it before they disappear on the following year's return. Next up, private letter ruling, a case of, well, that was a good try. 2016-16-002, issued on April the 15th. In this case, the employer wished to encourage his employees to contribute to a political action committee that had been funded up that basically looked to the employees of the company for all of its money, the officers and employees of the company. And what they decided to do was, if you made a certain minimum contribution to political action committee, you would be allowed to, they would make a charitable contribution on your behalf to a 501c3 charity of your choosing. The company said, you know what, we understand that we're not allowed to deduct contributions that are made to political candidates. But in this case, we're making a charitable contribution. So shouldn't we be able to claim a deduction for the contribution that we made to the charity? Because this isn't the political contribution. However, the IRS notes that Section 162 bars both direct and indirect contributions in support of someone running for political office or trying to influence such an election directly or indirectly. The IRS said because these contributions are without question directly linked to political activity that is directly linked to influencing political action in an election, these charitable contributions would not be considered deductible. So the service refused to issue the private letter ruling approving this program that the taxpayer sought and instead said that this would not represent an amount that would be considered a deductible expense to the company that paid it. Next up, now let's get to the goofiness of the week. This is the Seventh Circuit in the case of Roberts versus Commissioner from the Seventh Circuit, case number 15-336, issued on April the 15th. Now, this required whether a taxpayer had a profit motive. This is a Section 183 hobby loss case for losses from his racehorse operation. The tax court, interestingly enough, had ruled that for 2 years, he had a hobby. But then in year three, they decided it became a business. Mr. Roberts appealed this decision to the Seventh Circuit, who overturned the opinion, stating that essentially they didn't see that there was any justification for this inconsistent. There was a business at this year, but the 2 year previous there weren't. They saw no real distinctions. They saw that the facts didn't support the case. But then Judge Posner went on to write his little criticism. If you're aware, under Section 183, we have a 9 factors that are listed in the regulations to be considered in determining whether somebody has a profit motive or not. And the 9 factors are all listed, and every case you read on 183 always walks through these 9 factors in detail. Judge Posner essentially said and called them specifically goofy regulation, stating that it was effectively unworkable. Rather, what he suggested was outlining a more generic test that he felt was actually far more likely to make sense and actually be something that could be applied. What he noted in his was, he said what we really should do is consider that normally businesses are operated for a profit motive, but that some businesses, like horse racing, attract a lot of, shall we say, people who have interest in it not for making money. And in such cases, we will presume that they are in the activity not for making money, but you have to inquire into the taxpayers' motivations themselves. And the Seventh Circuit argued that by doing that, you would come to the proper conclusion. Now, it's interesting because the Seventh Circuit did not say the reg was invalid, but it certainly appears the Seventh Circuit, citing an earlier Seventh Circuit case, this opinion, is effectively saying that we're kind of ignoring the regulation and we're going to use a more generic test, at least here. Whether that's what actually happens will be interesting to tell. My guess is the tax court will continue to recite the 9 factors because the Seventh Circuit opinion did not specifically call the regulation itself invalid, rather just suggested it was a problem regulation. Well, it may be a problem, but it's still there. Next up, This goes back to an original problem that came up back in February. This is Chief Counsel Memorandum AM-2016-001, issued on April the 15th. This memorandum never mentions, but is specifically related to, Chief Counsel Advice 2016-06027, issued on February 5th that we discussed earlier. That Chief Counsel Advice originally found that what is referred to in the industry as a bad boy provision, a specific bad boy provision, took debt from being qualified non-recourse debt in the partnership to being recourse debt. A bad boy provision, to let you know, generally, when you set these up, the bank will say, okay, we agree to only take the building if, in fact, the partnership fails to pay on the debt. By doing that from a qualifying lender, you set up qualified non-recourse financing. And if you are doing a real estate deal where you're going to set up a limited partnership to own the building, you want to have that because, as we should all know, debt always creates basis for the partners. But generally, if it's non-recourse, it doesn't create amounts at risk. But qualifying non-recourse debt creates amounts at risk. Okay, it's all well and good. But here's the problem. If that debt is recourse under the rules for allocating debts to a partnership, you have to allocate that debt to the parties that would actually bear the negative effect if in essence, the partnership fell apart and somebody had to pony up money to pay things off. It uses what's referred to as an atomic bomb scenario to effectively write all the partnership assets down to zero, then look at the partnership agreement and figure out who's going to end up with a negative capital account. And that person will be under this agreement because the others don't have to put money in. It's going to be the person that guaranteed the debt. That's the person who has to do it. In a bad boy provision, what it says is if certain things happen, like, for instance, the general partner ever admits the partnership is insolvent, which could put the lender in a bad position, then it says if they ever admit that in writing, then the general partner now has to make good on a guarantee for the debt. The IRS had ruled in the 2016-06027 Chief Counsel Advice that such an arrangement made the debt recourse. That would blow up a large number of partnerships that are real estate structured because the allocation of debt would be wrong and there'd be no qualified non-recourse debt. What ended up happening in this case was there'd been many complaints from that original Chief Counsel Advice. The IRS backed off it. Now in this Chief Counsel Memorandum, the IRS has effectively reversed themselves there. They claim these are normal provisions. It would be against the partner's interest to ever do any of these things. They're all voluntary. And it decided that, therefore, because of that, none of these, and it actually lists specifically a set of conditions that it effectively finds are normal and blessed. So when you read the current advice, you're going to find a list of 7 specific types of provisions in a loan that are effectively blessed by this memorandum. So in any event, the IRS has effectively reversed position. And they're going to now not quite work the way they had before. Next up, we have final regulations. This is under Treasury Decision 9762, Regulation 534944-3, issued on April the 21st. This is one we knew about. We'd had proposed regulations. The IRS added examples to explain what is a program-related investment that's acceptable under Section 4944 that won't trigger the excise tax if you have investments that jeopardize the tax-exempt purposes. So these are investments you make because they further your tax-exempt purpose, not because they may be the best investment to make from an investment standpoint. The IRS, because of the proposed regs, clarified one example based on comments in the proposed regs, and but they did not specifically do what one person asked for, add a list of guiding principles to the regs in detail. Those list of principles are found in the preamble to the proposed regs. They're repeated in the preamble to the final regs, but the IRS felt that the examples make these guiding principles clear enough. They don't have to recite them in the regulations themselves. Nevertheless, those guiding principles, which, by the way, we do reproduce in the story on the site and we reproduce in the PDF we're giving you for this week, will tell you essentially what those are. Finally, playing ostrich didn't work here. For the case of Verabo versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2066-66, issued on April the 14th. In this case, we have an innocent spouse question. And in one sense, the wife looks like the perfect innocent spouse. The understatement of income came from her husband's business entirely. Her husband handled the books for those business, for the business. Her husband prepared the returns. So she signed the returns. Now, the catch is there's a couple of problems that came up here. First thing is, she signed the returns without reading them. Now, the returns indicated that his mortgage brokerage business had suddenly, for 2 years, generated major losses and then wasn't on the return at all for the next 2 years. Also, they hadn't actually filed returns during that time frame. He only filed returns, and she only became aware they hadn't been filed when the IRS gave him a notice. So these returns are presented to her to file when she knows they're being given to the IRS because the IRS is saying, wait, we don't have a return from you, and they're threatening to prepare one for them. So she knows they're going to have heightened scrutiny. She also knew their standard of living had not changed. The tax court agreed with the IRS that, look, she was an educated woman who took care of the family finances. She knew their standard of living had not changed. Had she looked at the return, she would have wondered how their income could have been that much lower when, in fact, she was still able to make all the bill payments and was still able to keep their standard of living up. There would have been reasonable questions to be asked. She, however, simply signed the return. You can't get innocent spouse if you essentially don't pay any attention to the returns. There was no evidence he threatened her. There was no evidence that she signed under any form of duress. She just signed because they were put in front of her, and so she just asked where to sign. Unfortunately, when you do that, you don't have much chance in innocent spouse relief. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 25th, 2016. Be sure to listen in next week for our developments on current taxes, and also be sure to visit us on our site at currentfederaltaxesdevelopments.com. You can sign up there for an email of articles every day that we post, and we have links to all of the cases that we talked about here. We also have on that site the video and audio that we publish each week, as well as a PDF that you can download with all of these articles written up for you so you can read along. And, you know, you can have them in a PDF format. You want to print them out, that's fine. Be sure to also check your state society's catalog for those live education courses coming up. Remember, I've got courses coming up this month in Arizona, or coming up, I should say, in May, in Arizona, in Washington, and Oregon. And the state societies have a bunch of other courses that you probably should take a look at. Also, my partner, Don Cochran, has cases coming up in Michigan this month. So you want to take, or coming up in May, I should say. When I say this month, it's May. Some of you will be listening to this probably in May. So be sure to take a look at and take a look, consider signing up for those courses. And as I said, take care. We'll be watching, and we'll see you next week again as we talk about the current federal tax developments.